Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. Today, ISF CEO Steve Durbin sits down with Jonathan Moore, CTO of SpiderOak, a data security software design firm in Silicon Valley. Steve and Jonathan discuss digital transformation, creating zero trust models that work, and the future of information security and big tech. Here's Steve.
Jonathan, thanks very much for joining me today. This season, our podcast is focused on digital transformation. And I especially wanted to get a bit of a status from you on digital transformation in this ongoing season, given that, you know, COVID is at various stages around the world. In the UK, we're emerging from it. In the US, similarly, other parts of the world are not quite so fortunate. But one of the things that the pandemic has done, I think, is accelerate digital transformation. So, you know, things like rapidly distributing workforces and information, really when there wasn't much time to prepare for it. So let's start there. How do you think cybersecurity leaders are faring 18 months into global disruption? Or what's their report card, if you like, for managing security while coping with these sorts of shifts in physical and digital processes?
Our background and my background is application security rather than information security. Yes, I think a lot about how we fit into the information security world. You know, I don't have feet on the ground there, but I think that overall what I see from the selling side of that equation is that people haven't really changed how they do things.
Right.
I mean, I think that this digital transformation is pushing the zero trust because people have just had to give up on the idea that they had control of the network at all. Right. As people move to their home networks.
Right.
But I don't think we've seen like a massive shift. I mean, people are spending more on Zoom. Right. But are there any new tools or new approaches that have really showed up? I mean, I think beyond the rise of zero trust, I don't think we've seen a lot. And the adoption of zero trust is still fairly small. You know, I may say this again later because I think it's part of a bigger trend. But I think the challenge that people have and the biggest challenge in adapting to a new environment, whether it be a change in adversarial behavior, which we've certainly seen over the last 15 years, even 5 years, or a change in where your, you know, employees sit, is that, you know, security is not the outcome of technology, right? Technology are controls and they don't provide security. Like if you buy a lock for your front door, that doesn't keep people from walking in. It's a process and the protocol of locking it, policy of locking it, having a policy that you action to lock your door stops people from walking in. And I think that changing processes is very hard for organizations. And I think that's one of the challenges that we've seen. And I think that this digital transformation is you're going to see a lot of challenges in, is that moving to a different environment requires a change in process to maintain security. And that's the big challenge that organizations are really going to face.
So were you surprised that there weren't some of these sort of big shifts during the last 18 months? Or do you think that the status quo would be preserved, that even though with all of this, you know, pandemic and that kind of thing, because I'm getting the sense that you think perhaps, maybe not, but I think perhaps there was a missed opportunity there.
Well, I don't think the tools were ready, right? I mean, I wish our new product had been more mature when all of this happened.
Right.
Because I think basically, there was no time, like the market was changed suddenly and everybody had to use the tools that were available rather than the tools that could be,
right?
And so people adopted the practices of what they could. So I think that in that sense, it's sort of not surprising, right? Because we had a market that demanded tool X and all of a sudden we needed tool Y.
Right.
There wasn't time to build tool Y in that time frame and nobody had built one speculatively. And so, I mean, in some ways, we needed tool Y, we needed video conferencing, right? But people had built that because, you know, distance exists. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have in terms of how are we going to manage the security of most of our network being external. We didn't have those tools built because that market didn't really exist. So in that sense, it's not surprising.
Right. In a recent blog post that I saw, you wrote that we're failing at cyber at all levels. And I think you wrote something along the lines of, you know, we've been fixing leaks in a plumbing system that's fundamentally unsound, taking a tactical approach to a strategic problem and hoping that tactics from the physical world will work in cyberspace. Tell me a little bit more about that. What exactly were you getting at there?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the way we write software, it roughly hasn't changed since the 60s or 70s. Fundamentally, we write programs that run with all the privileges of a user as that user. So there, I mean, I actually have to talk about several aspects if you want to understand that wholly. So I'm talking particularly about the controls. And that is a fundamentally unsound way to write software, because it means that where you intended your image viewer to have the capability to open an image and display it on the screen, that image viewer could in fact do whatever your user can do.
Right.
So any misstep in that image viewer program gives it the full capability of your user. And I think that's the fundamental challenge we're struggling against. And it doesn't even require bugs in software. If you look at the Fin7 cybercrime group, they didn't use zero days. They just got people to download and run Trojans.
Right.
And as soon as they could convince somebody to do that, it was game over, because that software, the user did not intend that software to be able to do whatever that permissions that user had, but it could. And so the question though is like, okay, why are we there? I mean, I think to take just a step back to sort of set the stage clearly, fundamentally, what we need to do is get to a point where software is safe for the users that run it and the networks that it's run on. And we are just so far from there, right? And so the question is why? Mm-hmm. Why are we farther? After decades of research into computer security, you know, with great advances in formal methods, with concepts like the, from the capabilities world of object capabilities. And it's not that we don't know how to write secure software. It's that we don't know how to set the incentives right so that we either will pay the cost of doing so, or will bring the costs down to match the current development approaches.
Right.
And there's a lot of reasons for that. There's liability outside of property damage or harm to a person or death. The, you know, manufacturers carry no liability for errors in their software. If there's a zero day in Chrome and somebody uses that to steal my banking credentials and empties my business account of all of its money, I lose all of that money.
Right.
And Google has no liability in that situation. And as a consumer of that software, I don't even have the tools to evaluate whether one piece of software is more reliable or has better assurance than another piece of the software. Mm-hmm. And in fact, even if somebody told me, oh, you should buy this very fancy thing, it's not clear that I should, because I think an honest sales pitch for a piece of InfoSec software goes like this. If you're the customer and I'm the salesperson, I would say, hey, customer, you have an unquantified exposure to cyber risk. I don't know what your exposure is. You don't know what your exposure is. Neither of us can quantify it. I have a product which shifts the needle on that exposure in an unquantified amount. Why don't you give me some money? Right. And it's the fact. Now, if you're thinking to yourself as the customer, well, neither me nor my vendors can quantify my risk.
Right.
But I do know the risk of not meeting this contract or not getting the new product out to market in time. And there's a lot of my business risks I have a fairly good, at least intuitive quantification of. So if I'd say spend money on the thing that I have no knowledge of or the thing I do, I should spend more money on the thing that I can quantify. On cyber, largely, people are just going to make sure that they pass the bar of negligence. And that's the right choice, because we don't have the regulations to guide them or the tools available to let them make better choices.
So given, and I wouldn't disagree with your assessment of the situation, but given that that is the state we find ourselves in, what are the answers? How can we take some positive steps forward there?
Personally, and we as an organization at Spider Oak, we believe that there is a place for software that you can just trust. And I think it's definitely a challenge getting it to market and convincing the customers. But I think the key thing is that we also need to build software that doesn't encumber you by having awkward security controls. That same motivation of, you know the risk of your business. If I'm an employee and I know I'm not going to get that raise or I'm going to be fired if I don't get a report out on time, damn all the security controls. I'm going to make sure that I get that report out on time, right?
Right.
If I have to put a file on a thumb drive and share it with somebody, that's what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the things on the human level that we are challenged with is a lot of our security controls get in the way of the responsibilities we've given our employees. So I think a key part of this is to build high assurance security controls that are flexible and empower individuals to make the choices they need to do to exercise their responsibility inside the organization. I think that we also need to look at it from the other side of, if this is a commons problem, that is a place where I think that some policy or regulation might be a good choice. And I don't mean to say that we need to regulate like we regulate vehicles.
Right.
I would look more towards the kind of ways that we look at pollution as a regulatory regime, because I think that's a better fit model. I mean, we're going to want to look at what we've done in the past,
right?
But that's always going to be a challenge because cyber is fundamentally different. Basically, outside of financial regulation, there is some locality to where things happen. If I spill chemicals at location A outside of a disaster like Chernobyl, right? Mostly that's going to happen at location A. There are very few things outside of cyber we have in our experience that what I do here in Portland affects you where you are across the world. And because distance doesn't exist on the internet in cyberspace, that makes things very different. I think the big differences are distance doesn't exist and that proliferation is impossible to stop. So without going down that rabbit hole, we can kind of think in terms of the way we think of pollution, where we want to both create incentives to create cleaner, which, you know, in this case would be more high assurance controls, as well as disincentivize the continued operation of particularly dirty, or in this case, very vulnerable systems. And so very particularly, like, how do we get people to retire old IoT infrastructure, which is not new, right? Mm-hmm. Network printers are IoT, and they've existed for a very long time.
Right.
How do we incentivize getting those things off our networks when they have forever days in them? The big challenge of IoT is not that, oh my gosh, now there's microphones in my house. The big challenge of IoT is that the deployment life is almost always significantly longer than the support life. You buy an IoT product and maybe the vendor will support it for 3 to 5 years and it's going to sit on your network for 5 to 10 to 15 right. years.
Yeah.
So if we don't have high assurance controls on those devices, then they're guaranteed to have unpatched vulnerabilities in them for a significant, if not majority of their life. So how do we incentivize getting those things off the network? And how do we incentivize people buying things that have high assurance controls in them? Not that there's a lot of options for high assurance controls on the market today, because there's no incentive to buy them today.
Right.
Or low incentive.
So you talk about regulation and you use the analogy of pollution, which is an interesting one. I've not heard that one before. Regulation, though, sensible regulation requires a high degree of understanding of some of the topics and themes that you've just been talking about. How do we get ourselves as an industry to a position where the people responsible for regulating and coming up with the regulations have the most appropriate level of understanding, so that the regulation that is being created is supportive of business and what we're trying to do, as opposed to a knee-jerk reaction or a political response?
I think that's a really good question. The concentration of wealth in our market does make that challenging. So
right.
any regulation is certainly going to be against the interests of the trillion or near trillion dollar businesses that we now have in our world, right? All of the richest people in the world are the richest people in the world these days, not because of energy anymore, but because of software.
Right.
So I think that is a really big challenge. Those are not easy systems to create clear regulations for. Most people think of individual devices and their software, but a plant right. is a single machine that's made up of tons of devices with individual
that's right.
software.
Yeah.
And so they're very hard to think about and manage. And in fact, compared to our desktop computers and our homes, they're far easier to defend at the edges because really they don't have a lot of need to be connected to a global network, unlike all of our communication tools, right? I mean, our home automation tool, the whole point is connected to the network.
Right.
So I'm not really giving you very good answers here, to be honest. Creating regulation is a challenge. Maybe we should take, you know, in the US, there is an organization called NERC-CIP, which is a quasi-governmental organization that's a energy industry group that essentially runs like a government body to regulate power in the US. And this was created by the energy industry after one of the major blackouts on the East Coast to prevent government regulation from stepping in. And maybe that's a way we could do it in private industry. This is an area where I see the systematic need and a potential solution, but it isn't clear to me how to fix it. In terms of what we should be thinking about, we should go look to examples of high assurance software and try and think about how can we describe that versus what we produce. It's not that we don't know how to create low defect software. The space shuttle program famously had no on-mission faults in the flight computer, and that is 500,000 lines of code. That's a feat. But if you look at today, one of the challenges is high assurance software tends to be 100 or so times more expensive than traditional software engineering practices. And that's a real challenge, especially as the market pressure is to drive down the cost of software engineering. We need more cheap code. As we put microprocessors and in fact, full-on computers and more things, the demand is going to be to reduce the cost of code, not accept an increase. I don't think it's impossible though. You know, a practical example, and I'm using this because I know it well.
Right.
Okay. Like what we've done at Spider Oak is said, hey, let's drastically reduce what code we need to trust. And we've done that by taking what you'd have traditional controls you'd implement on the server, right? And you say, well, I'm going to say, here's some access control lists, and here's my logic to implement who can read or write what files or change what permissions. And we've got all that control logic and we've got to go trust the server for this. And the server is kind of a challenge because it has high exposure. It's always on the network. And there's a high reward for an adversary to compromise it because they kind of win everything. It's a single point of failure in the system. We said, what we've realized is, hey, you can implement all those same kind of controls directly on the data itself using cryptography. So there's the traditional model where you had a network model where you build your perimeter around your organization and your sort of controls were network level. Now the trend is going to zero trust where we move the network to around the application. It's still fundamentally a network level control, but the perimeter is the around the application instead of around the organization. And we've said, like, you know what we could do is with cryptography, we can go to data center controls where the controls are on the data itself. And you do that with cryptography, right? So a very simple example is if I want to put a control read access, if I encrypt that, now only people who have access to the key can read that file. Right? It's a very, very simple example of that. And it doesn't matter what controls I've implemented in my infrastructure. I can throw my data on a public website that the entire world can read the ciphertext. But without that key, the control is still maintained. So we're able to, with cryptography, move that to the point that it has to be, which is the endpoints. In the end, your endpoint needs to put some pixels on a screen to display some data. So that has to have access to the data, and we can move that data all the way to the edge. So what we've done there is we've changed the problem, and we don't even have to worry about how high assurance the controls and the infrastructure are. Those just need to be there largely to prevent abuse. And, you know, we don't want somebody on the internet uploading, you know, petabytes of wares or movies or whatever to that server and having a nightmare for us. But a breach of the infrastructure no longer impacts the security controls we tried to implement over the data. And in the end, the data is what we're trying to control. That was a very long answer. I could probably clarify that more shortly if you had a refining question.
No, I think it was very interesting, actually, to follow your thought process there as you explained the different stages. I'm sure that the people listening here will be thinking, if only I could do something like that in my organization. Because for me, we've talked a little bit about the need for regulation. Where did we go with that? How do we get there? We're now talking about some of the specifics that you've just highlighted. I think that there's almost a sort of a step back from that for people listening. Don't say, well, I get the sort of direction of travel. I get where we want to try to go. But my reality today, I go back to the point you made about Chrome, for instance, and Google and liability and so on. My reality today is I'm using software. You know, I have it on all of my systems. I am sharing data. What are the sort of practical things that I can do today that are going to be able to protect my data and increase the level of security there, notwithstanding all the things you've talked about, because that's a future for a lot of organizations, because, you know, they're in the trenches at the moment. What are the sorts of things they can practically do? You know, you've mentioned zero trust on a number of occasions. You know, maybe that's the way that we should go. What do you think about that?
Oh, I mean, I think certainly, you know, all the best practices that InfoSec people recommend today, you should do. You should know what's on your network. Zero trust is great, not just from a standpoint of containing breach when it happens, but also from actually being able to do threat hunting and saying like, hey, this segment of my network is supposed to only run my IoT light system. Why is there this traffic that doesn't belong there on it?
Right.
You know, right now, if you look into the network architecture we've inherited from the 90s, there's one big network and there's so much traffic on it. It's a bright light that's very hard to look into and distinguish anything. When you go to zero trust, you start to be able to actually understand that traffic and reason about it, right? It gets to things you can quantify. So what can you do today? How can we scope the problem so it's easier to reason about? And zero trust is a good tool for that. You can also adopt where policy and regulation allow it with the tools available. You can adopt end-to-end. End-to-end is a data-centric control. When I use our products, CrossGlave, or I use Signal, or even WhatsApp, I know that my message is protected with a data-centric control so that the infrastructure can't manipulate or read the content of those messages.
Right.
A lot of it's just you can change the practices you have, right? If you have a very important credential that is used in a narrow regime in an organization, you can buy a different laptop that holds that credential that's not the daily laptop you use to do work. And essentially, this is a form of privilege separation, which is not a new idea. I mean, I think a lot of it is we don't need to invent new ideas. We need to apply the old ideas and figure out how to apply the old ideas to new, more complex environments than we have in the past. But if you have a separate laptop for those credentials, you can lock it in a physical safe and you can turn what was previously, if I had those credentials on my regular computer that's exposed to watering hole attacks and, you know, 0 days and all that stuff, because I'm browsing data constantly, right? All data is actually a program. So I'm running all sorts of programs on my machine constantly. They're controlled by adversaries. Why should I have my very high value credentials on that same device that I'm exposing to the world constantly? And, you know, once we turn a network attack into a physical attack, we've drastically changed the game, right? One, the attack is no longer open to everybody on the world. And two, the risk for the adversary is much higher. The cost for somebody in Russia to attempt to hack on your machine is zero. Right. They can't be extradited. If hacking your computer doesn't upset the powers that be in Russia, they have zero risk for that attempt. Breaking into your building and trying to steal a YubiKey or steal an offline device that holds credentials, that's a much higher risk attack for them. And the outcomes are high stakes for them if they get caught. It's not that these never exist. I mean, you look at some of the high value attacks against people who use cryptocurrency, and these groups will send somebody into a phone store in New York to say, oh, hey, I lost my SIM. I need my phone. I need a new SIM, so that they can break the 2FA using the cell. So they exist, but they make them much higher risk and more expensive and, you know, change the operations of the adversary.
And that's the key to it, really, isn't it? We got to try to move away from it being too easy. I mean, as soon as we can add a degree of complexity, as soon as we can add a degree of risk from the adversary's standpoint, we become less attractive and they move on. And I suppose, you know, I always talk to organizations about the need to do that, to make yourself look very unattractive from an adversarial standpoint. So they move on to the next guy.
Yeah, it's not just make it more expensive. You need to change the ratio of risk to reward.
Right.
So if the reward is high enough, it doesn't matter what the risk is. If I can have a $1 trillion attack, I'm going to take very high risks. I don't know, but I imagine the attackers who tried to steal money using the interbank transfer system a couple of years ago that tried to steal, what was it, $100 billion from, I think it was an Indian bank, or was it Pakistani? Yep. I don't remember.
That's right.
For $100 billion, you can go send a team of 10 people to Pakistan and maybe they're all going to die, but that's $100 billion. And you're going to find 10 people who will take a gamble there, right?
Right.
So I think you're right. Yeah, we need to increase the risk and we need to decrease the reward. I personally think that the big tool, and this zero trust is one of the example of this, but the big tool we need to be applying more from a policy and operational standpoint is compartmentalization, right? Zero trust is a form of compartmentalization. But I think compartmentalization is a tool that allows you to say, hey, when you breach the compartment, the rewards are lower. And you've now got to work again to breach the next compartment. And this can be done successfully. Governments do this successfully. you know, even some companies like Apple did this successfully. You know, as I understand it, I don't have firsthand knowledge, but it's my understanding that Apple uses a SCI or secure compartmentalized information for their sort of high value projects, such that the reason Apple doesn't leak is because they compartmentalize internally. Right. That shows you can do it as an organization. As an industry, we're not providing a lot of tools to help people do that, because you also need to be able to allow the compartmentalization to be agile, so you don't create friction that's going to cause people to go around your controls, employees to go around your controls to get their job done. So what can people do today is think about, how can I compartmentalize? My stance personally, when I sit down to a security problem, I start by asking myself, how can I make progress on the security challenge? Like, I want to protect my banking credentials or my online banking. How can I make progress if I assume my laptop already has an adversary on it? Because that's not an unreasonable assumption. And usually it's not that I can win and say, well, even if somebody's actively hacking it, you know, actively has remote access tool on my laptop, I probably am not going to win. But if I start with that thinking, it starts me in the right place and say, what's the safest thing I can do in that environment? And I think those are things that people can do today. Like, they could compartmentalize using end-to-end tools if appropriate. If you can use the consumer tools, great. If you can't, you know, we've been working on adding enterprise style controls and tools. If you could just use multiple laptops, laptops are cheap, really, when it comes down to it as an organization. You don't want to end up like you see some of these pictures of US officers who have like three computers on their desk because they're connected to three networks. And we don't want to like end up there, but you can think about like, hey, this is our root certificate. Maybe they shouldn't be on a computer that's online. Or even more simply, these are the keys I can use to deploy to production. Maybe that shouldn't be available on devices I do my day-to-day work on or I read email on. Maybe that should be a different device. And maybe it should have physical access controls on it.
Jonathan, I think it's been fascinating covering all of these different areas. I think that the really big takeaway for me, and one that I would encourage our listeners to really spend time thinking through, is the way you've been talking really brings to life, I think, the need for the business side of the house in the organization to get with the security and the technical side, because no two sides can do it alone. There are clearly solutions, and you've touched on a number of them, compartmentalization, zero trust, all of those sorts of things that organizations can implement, but it requires collaboration across the enterprise. And that's the one big takeaway I think that I would have for anybody listening to this podcast. You know, think about how you can really collaborate better within the organization. Get the most from your security guys, your technical guys. Help them to understand the needs of the business, and don't be afraid to change things. And I think you've given us some great examples of ways in which that can be done. So thank you very much indeed for your time. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks to this week's guest, Jonathan Moore. And listeners, if you want more information about Zero Trust, be sure to visit securityforum.org to access their recently produced Zero Trust briefing paper. Next week, we'll be in conversation with the retail doctor, Bob Phibbs, who shares his perspective on digital transformation in the retail market. Here's a preview of that conversation.
Folks who are listening right now, security people, you're all probably analyticals. You're like Spock in Star Trek. You know, you're like a surgeon. You're like anyone on this old house. You're a car mechanic, like a CPA. You have a process. You go to A to B to C to D to E to F to G. And that's great. I'm not like that, though. I'm a guy who speaks in shorthand. Right. And so I kind of go like, I go from A to M to Z. And another guy like me will be like, oh, I get that. The problem is, a lot of times people that are really analytic don't have the soft skills of how do I talk to someone who's not like me. So we make these assumptions that, you know, we want a 15-page bulleted report when the person in charge of it may not want any of that. They just want to know I can give it to you and it's gone, or you're going to be able to take the best of what you do because I don't have that. But making the assumption that we're alike, I think, costs you sales.
We'll be back for the full conversation in a week. In the meantime, is there a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode? Let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find that catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. Find us on LinkedIn by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. Follow our audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode. And if you like the ISF podcast, we'd love it if you'd write a short review. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak. Associate producer Katie Flood. Mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.